The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone. The views and opinions expressed are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent KCBQ or its sponsors. It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you find parts of the Bible so far-fetched, like Noah and the Ark. Who could swallow this stuff? He really put two of every kind of animal in the Ark? Every kind? Even kangaroos who live in Australia, a separate continent than what Noah lived on? How does that all work out? Well, we'll discuss this stimulating question later on in the program. First, the latest news. A word of comfort for my fellow conservatives. Are you worried that despite conventional wisdom, Republicans will not take back the House and the Senate this fall? Well, this might cheer you up. An interview for ABC provided by Vice President Joe Biden. Let's listen in.
I don't think the loss can be bad at all. I think we're going to shock the heck out of everybody. I really, and I've been saying this now, I think even when you and I went down to North Carolina, you followed me on a recovery trip. I was saying it then. I am absolutely confident. When people take a look at what has happened since we've taken office in November and comparing it to the alternative, we're going to be in great shape. Here's the deal. What Robert Gibbs also said was what he believes, what I believe, what the president believes. We're going to win the House and we're going to win the Senate. We're not going to lose either one of those bodies.
Now, it's not that I like what he said. It's just that Biden's track record isn't particularly accurate and isn't particularly truthful. How do we know when Joe Biden is lying? His lips are moving. I know, that's an old one. So let me introduce something new, a brand new feature on the Bob Siegel Show, our Joe Biden update. So Biden says Democrats will keep the House and Democrats will keep the Senate. Doesn't this give you hope and settle the matter once and for all? I mean, these sage words come from the man who told Katie Couric that following the stock market crash, President Roosevelt, not President Hoover, went on television, not radio, to explain the situation to our country. Naturally, that is only one of many fun Biden facts. When he debated Sarah Palin, he lied in ways that would have made Pinocchio blush. I'll give you an example. One of the most glaring lies was his retort to Palin that Obama never said he would sit down and talk with dictators without preconditions. Obama did say that. He said exactly that. He said it during a primary debate. He said it on TV. He said it while he was debating Joe Biden, because you might remember Biden himself was running for president at the time. You can still watch him give that statement because it's been recorded. He said it in front of Joe Biden. Biden even personally scolded him for it at the time. This same Biden who throughout the exchange insisted that Obama did not have what it took to be a commander-in-chief. That's what he says when he's running against him. He sings a different tune now that he's president. And that's just one example of 14 lies that he told when he was debating Sarah Palin. When he knows the truth, he lies. And when he tries to tell the truth, he still comes up short in the accuracy department. Make no mistake, if Biden promises Democrats will keep Congress, their loss can be taken to the bank. If there had been any doubt before, we can now cast it away. That's the good news. Unfortunately, I have some not so good news. What I am about to tell you folks would, under most circumstances, sound like the pipe dream of a right-wing wacko conspiracy theorist. But I don't think anyone will ever accuse the New York Times and the Washington Post of being conservative, and they both reported this on the same day. Yet, that's not the real news. The real news is the fact that I and so many others missed this report. The story is now several months old, but I heard nothing about it back then, and I hear little about it now. I'm going to read you the New York Times version from April 7, 2010. It says this: the Obama administration has taken the extraordinary step of authorizing the targeted killing of an American citizen, the radical Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who is believed to have shifted from encouraging attacks on the United States to directly participating in them, intelligence and counterterrorism officials said Tuesday. American counterterrorism officials say Mr. al-Awlaki is an operative of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, the affiliate of the terror network in Yemen and Saudi Arabia. They say they believe that he has become a recruiter for the terrorist network, feeding prospects into plots aimed at the United States and at Americans abroad, the official said. It is extremely rare, if not unprecedented, for an American to be approved for targeted killing, officials said. A former senior legal officer in the administration of George W. Bush said he did not know of any American who was approved for targeted killing under the former president. The danger al-Awlaki poses to this country is no longer confined to words, said an American official, who, like other current and former officials interviewed for this article, spoke of the classified counterterrorism measures on the condition of anonymity. He's gotten involved in plots. Okay, let me comment on this. A lot to say, if I can stop gasping. Although disturbing in its own right, when we consider the fact that our Homeland Security Advisor Janet Napolitano has a much wider definition of people groups that might spawn terrorism, I find myself even more jittery. American citizens may understandably and unfortunately forget about our Constitution when the government goes after 9/11 type Middle East cutthroats, but Napolitano also expresses concern for groups like veterans, pro-life advocates, those concerned about protecting our borders, and those who resent large government. No, she is not accusing them of being terrorists, but she is suggesting that such ideologies run the potential of inspiring terrorism. I hope I'm not alone in finding this a harrowing development, a threat to our republic, 100% unconstitutional, and arguably the most dangerous development in American history. But just in case you aren't grasping the big picture, let me spell it out more plainly. Our president believes he has the right to order the assassination of American citizens without any due process so long as they are suspected of terrorism. This same president works with a security advisor who holds a disturbing view of where to watch for terrorists. God save us. And our country, our politically correct, sensitive country, elected this man. Why? For what reason? Because he gave good speeches? Because he promised hope and change? Because people were afraid that they'd be racists if they didn't vote for an African-American? Well, now we have him. A president at the moment, but fast on his way to becoming a dictator. You think I'm exaggerating? Well, think about this. If the power to assassinate a citizen is not the description of a dictator, shouldn't the word dictator just be taken out of the dictionary?
And the people bowed and prayed to the neon god they made. And the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, the tenement halls, whispering the sounds of silence.
Looking to build your own website without a lot of cost and trouble? Hi, I'm Bob Siegel, here to tell you about Web Studio. Web Studio allows people to create their own websites simply and easily without knowing HTML. With Web Studio, you avoid the learning curve of front page and the expense of a web designer. Web Studio has 14 different galleries that contain graphics, sounds, and everything else you need. For more information about Web Studio, go to webstudio.com.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170, 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. Senator Chris Dodd told us that the latest financial regulation bill was, like health care, something we needed to pass first and then later find out what's inside. Well, see how you like this little Tootsie Roll hidden in the crunchy fruit-flavored candy. Now, our government has the right to shut down any business they feel has an improper race or gender mix. Let me say that again. Our government has the right to shut down any business they feel has an improper race or gender mix. You figured that other bill about the assassination that I did before the break, you didn't think it could get worse than that. Well, maybe not worse. Maybe they're a photo finish. And this from the reigns of Obama, who campaigned as one who would be a racially uniting president and put race behind us once and for all. More like a racially dividing dictator. And where does our Constitution give the government permission to shut down businesses for such reason or for any reason at all? Oh, that's right. That's right. Nowhere. Speaking of constitutional ignorance, U.S. District Judge Susan Bolton issued an injunction forbidding the most important parts of the new Arizona law until such time that the Obama administration's lawsuit can have its day in court. Okay, let's back up to make sure we have the story straight. At first, the Obama administration claims it's going to sue Arizona because policemen asking people for their papers would be racial profiling. The law specifically forbids such profiling, but the Obama administration insists this is still the real issue. Then, when the suit is finally filed, the stated reason changes. Now the problem is that supposedly a state cannot enforce a federal law. Enforcing a federal law somehow means interfering with a federal law. So now the government is concerned about the states interfering with federal laws. Some, like me, note at this time that the Obama administration has no problem with sanctuary cities that are definitely in violation of federal law. Judge Bolton's injunction supports Obama's opinion about the alleged conflict of interest in a state enforcing a federal law, but she also went back to Obama's originally stated concern, commenting that the detainment of people while checking papers can violate the rights of legal immigrants. Question, just a bonehead question. If this law is wrong for duplicating the effort of the federal law, and if this same federal law does have a right to detain people while checking their records, is Judge Bolton also claiming our federal law is unconstitutional? Someday, future generations will look back with wonder and amazement. Yes, kids, it's true. There was a very strange time in American history when a judge ruled that it was unconstitutional for a policeman to enforce the law. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious. And now moving on, I'm reading from The Hollywood Reporter, July 26, 2010, just a few days ago, from New York. The Anti-Defamation League on Monday slammed filmmaker Oliver Stone for comments he made to the Sunday Times in the UK, calling them anti-Semitic. Abraham Foxman, ADL national director, said, "Oliver Stone has once again shown his conspiratorial colors with his comments about Jewish domination of the media and control over U.S. foreign policy. His words conjure up some of the most stereotypical and conspiratorial notions of undue Jewish power and influence." Stone issued an apology Monday afternoon, saying, "In trying to make a broader historical point about the range of atrocities the Germans committed against many people, I made a clumsy association about the Holocaust, for which I am sorry and I regret." When asked in an interview with the Sunday Times of London why there was such, quote-unquote, a focus on the Holocaust, Stone had replied, "The Jewish domination of the media." He added, "They stay on top of every comment, the most powerful lobby in Washington. Israel has," and then he used that famous F word that we're not allowed to say because of FCC regulations, "Israel has effed up the United States foreign policy for years." The American Jewish Committee also weighed in Monday, comparing Stone to Mel Gibson. "By invoking this grotesque, toxic stereotype, Oliver Stone has outed himself as an anti-Semite," said AJC Executive Director David Harris. "For all of Stone's progressive pretensions, his remark is no different from one of the drunken, Jew-hating rants of his fellow Hollywood celebrity, Mel Gibson." The American Gathering of Holocaust Survivors and their descendants also released a statement Monday. "We are deeply offended. These are words of hate and a disgraceful evocation of anti-Semitism. Shame on Oliver Stone." Times of London articles are behind a paywall, but that didn't stop many publications from reprinting the quotes. Stone made his comments in the context of discussing his new documentary, South of the Border, which concerns Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. By the way, Stone loves Hugo Chavez. He had a real problem with George Bush, but he loves that dictator, Hugo Chavez. Anyway, I will continue reading this news article. It says it isn't the first time Stone has made a controversial comments about the Holocaust. In January, he characterized Hitler as an easy scapegoat in support of his upcoming Showtime miniseries, Oliver Stone's Secret History of America. Yeah, it's such a secret. He doesn't have the history correct. Continuing to read, Stone's comments were echoed in Israel, where Yuli Edelstein, Minister of Diaspora Affairs and Public Diplomacy, weighed in. "When a man of Stone's stature says such things, it could lead to a new wave of anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism, and it may even cause real harm to Jewish communities and individuals. Jews obviously do not control media or any other industry," Stone's statement continued. "The fact that the Holocaust is still a very important, vivid, and current matter today is, in fact, a great credit to the very hard work of a broad coalition of people committed to the remembrance of this atrocity." And it was an atrocity. Well, these were Stone's words in The Hollywood Reporter, trying to clean up things he had said earlier. Well, it's always nice to hear an apology. It is. Unfortunately, Stone said some things that simply cannot be taken back. I mean, he can tell us that he's sorry he said them. He can't tell us what he really meant, because what he really meant is clear. I mean, has he suddenly overnight learned that Jews are not the most powerful lobby in Washington? Did he immediately change his foreign policy opinion? Or does he still think Israel has effed up United States foreign policy for years? Throughout history, anti-Semitism has been a difficult phenomenon to explain or understand. For the last 2,000 years, anti-Semitism has not only demonstrated man's inhumanity to man, it has also been a puzzle and a bewilderment to the entire world. Nothing, and I mean nothing, about anti-Semitism makes sense. Consider the following. The only thing that the extreme right and the extreme left have in common is a hatred for Jews. Some people view Judaism as a religion. Others view Judaism as a race. It gets hated equally for either designation. Those who object to the religion are known to call the Jews Christ killers. But this only shows how little they understand Christianity, because the Bible teaches that Jesus meant to die, that it was God's will to offer him as a sacrifice for our sins, that if not for our sins, he would not have needed to perish, and as a result, we are all responsible for his death. One who does not understand this concept, basic and foundational to the gospel, does not understand Christianity and is not a true follower of Jesus Christ. For this reason, the bigots' disdain for Jews is actually not religious at all, and we are forced to view such hatred as a mystery. On the other hand, those who view Jewish people as a race have a difficult time explaining exactly what it is about the race that they don't like. Is it the skin color? Not all Jews have the same color of skin. Some are tanned, but the Jews in Sweden have blonde hair and blue eyes. They don't all have big noses either, and even if they did, Many people have big noses. Those with big noses who are not Jewish are not hated. Okay, well, maybe it's those nasty Jewish traits then. After all, aren't they a conspiracy of communists trying to take over the world? Actually, just as many suggest that they are a conspiracy of greedy capitalistic bankers trying to take over the world. The Nazis found it useful to accuse them of both at the same time, hoping nobody would notice the contradiction. For those who believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, this mystery finds a partial explanation in what the Bible calls spiritual warfare. You may not believe in the existence of good angels and evil spirits. Other radio shows of mine have defended their existence. For now, let's just stipulate that whatever your opinion of the Bible, this is just exactly what the Bible teaches. Demonic beings seek to keep people from the love of God, and these beings especially hate the Jews. They hate the Jews because through the Jews the Messiah came into the world. They hate the Jews because through the Jews we received the Bible, both Old and New Testament. The ability of demons to foster irrational hatred may be a missing piece of the puzzle here. But you don't wish to accept this idea? So be it. I hope you will at least agree with me that anti-Semitism is a mystery because it makes absolutely no sense. Unfortunately, its lack of logic does not keep it from spreading. For a while, it seemed as though most of modern civilization had put anti-Semitism out in the pasture where it belongs. Unfortunately, it's returning like gangbusters. Anti-Semitism is as bad today as it has ever been, and it's growing all over the world, not just the Arab world, but Europe once again. Europe, where it had a happy home not so long ago. Without attempting to explain the entire revival, I can say that the Israeli-Palestinian situation serves as the current fuel for hateful, ignorant fires. Notice Stone's own comments quoted earlier about the Middle East. Until we correct the historical revision, until we realize that the Jews, not the Palestinians, have been willing to share the Holy Land and live in peace, until we understand that there has never ever been any illegal occupation, that Israel was legally given this land by the United Nations, and that further land was taken only after surrounding Arab countries threatened to wipe Israel off the face of the earth, until we understand that the Palestinian Charter does not recognize Israel's right to exist, until we understand that no concession will be enough and no two-state solution will be enough, that the Palestinian authorities simply want Israel dead, period, and until we deal with the cold truth that today's universities and today's media are spreading disinformation about Israel, I'm afraid anti-Semitism is here to stay. But there is some silver lining. The Jews, once again, unwillingly but clearly, have proven to humankind that it has not advanced or evolved morally. This truth smacks head into the smugness and arrogance of our politically correct generation. But future generations will look back on 21st century conceit as a second dark age. Liberal, enlightened director Oliver Stone has become the very thing he believes his movies speak against. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I hope you're having a pleasant Sunday afternoon. It's always good to have you here. You are always welcome. Your questions are welcome, too. You can reach us live over the phone at 1-888-344-1170. That's 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach me on the internet, questions@bobsiegel.net, questions@bobsiegel.net. These days, many are communicating to us through Facebook, and you can also reach us at Twitter. Regarding the overturning of the Arizona law, Peter writes, "Hey, Bob, if a state cannot enforce federal law, can it enforce freedom of speech?" I don't think our current government quite gets the idea behind freedom of speech, Peter. If not, they wouldn't be talking about things like hate crimes when they hear things they don't like to hear. They wouldn't be talking about fairness doctrines. Anyway, it goes on. Renee writes, "Here's some interesting food for thought for you, directly from the U.S. Constitution, Article 4, Section 4. Ready?" We're ready, Renee. It says, "The United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion." So you tell me what legal legs this judge has to stand on. Renee, the legal legs are not there. The judge has none. It's just that judges make the law up as they go today, and they claim they're interpreting the Constitution. But the truth is, if the Constitution says something they don't like, they find hidden meaning in there. It's amazing. Now, on Facebook, you may recall over the weeks, I've read from two different Maureens. They write me a lot, and they say very profound things, so I read them a lot. Normally, I do not give out last names over the air, but they freely give their names over Facebook, which is pretty public. So in this rare case, only in this rare case, I will use the last names to help you tell them apart. It just sounds more personal than saying Maureen 1 and Maureen 2. The first is from Maureen Coddington. She says, regarding the overturning of the Arizona law, "The liberals don't see this as an invasion, more like unregistered Democrats." Well put, Maureen. She says, "Bob, I have an article that I'll post later today about why both Democrats and most Republicans want immigrants, legal or illegal, and especially from Mexico. These are people that are easy to govern, are loyal to their government, and are already used to and accepting of corrupt elitist government official. The ideal constituent. You can see them willingly herded into buses from California to Arizona because some Democrat told them to, and a little help from Acorn. One footnote to Article 4, Section 4, the president's authority to call in troops, even without a state's request, was established in 1894, and here you have a state begging for protection. And in addition to invasion, this article also includes domestic violence, like the ranchers and Arizona citizens being murdered, raped, and terrorized near the border." Isn't it sad, Maureen, that we have a government who cares less about people being terrorized, murdered, and raped, and more about a voting bloc? So Maureen continues, she finishes, says, "So if invasion falls on deaf ears, domestic violence cannot be redefined." Now, regarding the government's new powers to close down a corporation if they don't like it, Maureen Coddington says, "Isn't fascism fun?" On that same subject, Maureen Chambers says, "I am scared for my country." Well, that makes two of us, Maureen. Now, this is a very interesting letter from Jen regarding last week's show about Christians arrested while sharing the gospel with Muslims. "Bob, sadly, you are posting things to incite hate against Muslims in America. Dearborn is the only city in America where they can feel safe at an event like this. You have got an agenda, sir, and you are not doing the work of God to make peace among people. You are spreading fear. That's it. I am not a Muslim, but I do not hate on them like you and your extremist group does. I have been welcomed with nothing but love among them. This would be a better way for you to exchange God's love." Well, Jen, I'm going to try to be patient with you, but it's not going to be easy. You have never heard me say one hateful thing about Muslims, and you cannot quote one hateful word. Neither were the people who were arrested in Dearborn doing anything but sharing their faith. I interviewed them. I don't even know if you listened to the interview. You just noticed that I posted it. They were doing nothing but sharing their faith. By the way, that is something Muslims themselves do all the time. Muslims share their faith. Muslims lead people to their religion. Now, I have lovingly shared the gospel with Muslims, and I have seen appreciative Muslims give their lives to Jesus. Frankly, Jen, your self-righteous letter exhibits the very judgment you just accused me of, that you wrote it in the name of the work of God and that you wrote it in the name of the love of God. makes it doubly sad. Now, I got to tell you, after getting that, Jen has written me again because she didn't think that letter was enough. This time she said my ministry has nothing to do with the real Jesus. She also accused me of being a false apologist, and she accused me of being a cult leader. I don't get comments like that often. Most of the feedback I've received over the years from Christians and skeptics alike is that they felt they were being treated with respect. If you've ever heard me debate anybody over the radio or take a caller who disagreed with me, I'm sure you've noticed that. But occasionally I do get letters like the one Jen wrote, and when I get them, since she's drawing a distinction between true and false Christianity, I like to read the words of the real Jesus. Jesus says, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." That was in Matthew 5. He also said in John 15, "If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belonged to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. Remember the words I spoke to you. No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also. They will treat you this way because of my name, for they do not know the one who sent me." Well, we got very different reactions from Evie, who listened to that program. Regarding that same program, Evie writes good, and she writes it with a lot of O's, so that it goes good. Kind of reminds me of Andy Griffith, remember? Good cracker. Goober. Good. And Maxine, listening to that same show, writes, "Wow, very good radio." Anne, on the same show, says, "Filming conversations with Muslims is kind of counterproductive in many ways toward evangelism. I understand they felt they needed to film, but what is the ultimate goal?" Well, that's a very fair question, Anne. Their original goal was to merely share the gospel. That's all they wanted to do. The cameras were brought in as an afterthought. They were brought in to disprove the accusations made against them the previous year. Now, I received this question recently on Facebook, and I alluded to it at the top of the hour. How did kangaroos, I love this, you just can't even read the word kangaroo without cracking up. Those things hopping around, carrying things in their pouch. How did kangaroos end up on Noah's Ark if kangaroos are in Australia only? All right, a couple of possibilities come to my mind when we contemplate the challenges associated with Noah and his plight. First of all, the concept of the term world has grown over the years. When Jesus commanded his disciples to carry the gospel to the entire world, the world they knew of was the Grecian Roman Empire and a few places beyond. The very idea that sailors could someday cross the Atlantic to discover a new continent like America would have been viewed by them similar to the way we might imagine an astronaut finding humanoid life on Mars and then wondering if we need to share the gospel with Martians. If such a space expedition ever took place, if we found ourselves populating our solar system and maybe even our galaxy long after that, the solar system or galaxy might be viewed as the world Jesus was going to someday return to. Back to Noah, the world which flooded may have been limited to Noah's world, that region known as Mesopotamia. If such were the case, only the animals in that particular world would have boarded the ark. We'll be right back. Good projects don't just happen. Good projects are a result of a team of dedicated professionals, owners, architects, and contractors striving toward a common goal. Make OMP a part of your team. If you're looking for professional, knowledgeable experience for your construction project team, Oso Miller Pacific should be your first call. For over 20 years, Mark Miller has been providing project management and constructive services throughout San Diego and Southern California. As president of Oso Miller Pacific, Mark continues this tradition of providing the most professional services in the industry to the healthcare, commercial, and government construction markets. Oso Miller Pacific provides a full range of pre-construction services, including definition of needs, design team selection, concept budget generation, and construction services. This full range of services is what sets Oso Miller Pacific apart from its competition. Visit their website at osomillerpacific.com. That's www.ossomillerpacific.com or call the offices at 619-449-0633. Again, the number is 619-449-0633. Good projects don't just happen. Call Osso Miller Pacific. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I was reading a question sent to me over Facebook by Alex. Alex has sent in some good questions before. How do we get kangaroos on the ark when kangaroos are only in Australia? It's a separate continent. And I mentioned that the concept of the term world is ever expanding, that the world the disciples knew of was the Grecian Roman Empire and a few places beyond, that the concept of crossing the ocean and finding a place called America and Native Americans and sharing the gospel to them would have been to them like us going to Mars and finding humanoid life up there, so that maybe the world Jesus returns to might be a whole solar system. And I said then, with that idea that world is an expanding term, maybe the world that flooded was Noah's world, the world of Mesopotamia, which would mean only the animals from that region were taken on board. Now, of course, there are many people today who believe that the entire world flooded. So let me throw out another possibility. Let's say the entire world did flood. When reading the Genesis account, the flood is described as more than just rain. We're told that the waters of the deep also burst forth. This could be referring to tidal waves caused by earthquakes or comets. I said comments. Well, I'm giving the comments, but it could have been caused by earthquakes or comets or some other cataclysm from long ago. Many geologists believe that our seven continents were once one continent. They also believe that in the Ice Age which followed, it would have been possible to cross from one continent to another. Now, the amount of time needed for such phenomenon to occur need not concern us, as I'm convinced the Bible is not trying to tell its readers how old the Earth is. I did a whole show about that once before. I'm sure I'll do it again someday. But for now, one thing we know for sure, there definitely was an ancient flood. Many cultures beside the Hebrew culture report on it. The Epic of Gilgamesh would be one such example. My next discussion is one that I like to revisit at least once a year. It's about all the misunderstandings Christians have about forgiveness. And with all that's going on in the news, we need this reminder. I call this the difference between forgiving and excusing. Now, not long ago, I forwarded some horrific pictures that had come my direction over the internet. They were snapshots of British Muslims demonstrating on the streets of London. Because Islam keeps claiming to be a religion of peace, and because the politically correct have bought this lie, I found those images telling and chilling. They speak volumes, not only about Islam's violence, but about her intentions to take over the Western world, an idea that today's naive elitists tend to laugh at. Some of the captions read, "Slay those who insult Islam." I guess I'm going to be on the list. Let me read another one of them. "Europe is the cancer, Islam is the answer. Islam will dominate the world." Sweet. Here's one. "Freedom, go to hell." Don't we always hear, "Oh, if only Muslims lived under a democracy." These are Muslims living under a democracy. They're living in Great Britain, and they're saying freedom go to hell. Here's one, "Europe, take lessons from 9/11. Unfortunately, Europe took no lessons from 9/11. Another one on these signs that we're being carried in London, "Europe, you will pay. Your 9/11 is on its way." Oh, here's a nice little ditty. "Be prepared for the real Holocaust." That means the Holocaust that the Jews claim never really happened, but it's actually not a bad idea, so we should have one. That's what that sign means. And finally, one of them said, "Exterminate those who slander Islam." Of course, their definition of those who slander Islam are those who tell the truth about Islam. Now, despite these photos, England comes down hard on those who criticize Muslims. England has also decided to stop talking about the Holocaust in public schools because its Muslim population does not believe the Holocaust even happened and finds such teaching offensive. And in Canada, it is now considered hate speech to speak against Islam. It's equally deemed hate speech in Canada to speak against homosexuality, even though homosexuality is against the law in most Muslim countries and punishable by death in many Muslim countries. You just have to see the irony. Now stop before you continue. I'll say it again. I've said it before. I'll say it again. Yes, I am aware that there are peaceful Muslims in the world. My purpose right now is not to get into a discussion about Islam. I have already written many articles on the subject. No, believe it or not, my concern at the moment is not Muslim theology, but rather Christian theology. And I'll tell you why. Because right now I'm just telling you about these pictures I saw. Well, here's what happened after I sent out the pictures. I, along with many others on the email list, received what appeared to be a loving challenge rebuke from a Christian brother sharing a page out of a book he had recently written. The subject was forgiveness. He was reminding us that we are to forgive our enemies. I will not mention the name of this person. I don't know him well, but I do know him, and from all that I've ever observed, he's an intelligent, loving, dedicated Christian brother. I have nothing but respect for him. There is no doubt whatsoever that he was speaking sincerely in a manner he hopes will please God. As far as his heart and motives are concerned, I am certain God is pleased. But this innocence is exactly what made the man's response so frustrating to me. Often the heart and the head are in two different places. Even smart, bright people can be sincerely misled. Still, his view is far from unique, and so I offer this response not to him alone, but to the countless Christians who need to hear some very important words, and I hope you're all paying attention. My concern comes from the fact that nowhere in the email containing the pictures did anyone ask Christians to not forgive Muslims or to not forgive their enemies. The purpose was simply to tell the truth. Islam is not a religion of peace. Indeed, Islam intends to take over the world. I doubt that they will succeed in such a goal, but we should understand the goal because a lot of havoc can be made in the meantime. Monstrous evil is in the wind and people need to be warned. Because I and others choose to inform the world about an evil enemy, will people automatically assume we are unforgiving? If so, something is drastically wrong with our current understanding of Jesus and his message. The truth is, Muslims today are coming to Christ in the tens of thousands, year after year. This is wonderful, and I rejoice to see the forgiveness of God. I have even had the pleasure of personally leading a Muslim to Christ. An Arabic Christian Perspective has had numerous guests on my radio program. None of this means I will be silent or refrain from discussing the many Muslims who have not, as of yet, repented, and who plan to spread a repressive cult. As Christians and American citizens, we owe it to our children to leave behind a culture and life as peaceful as the one we were blessed to experience. I'm convinced that today's generation of Christianity is quick to embrace the doctrine of forgiveness without really understanding it. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's daily blog on townhall.com. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net. Here, you download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
This is Bob Siegel inviting you to tune in for the Rick Amato Show four nights a week here on 1170 KCBQ. Rick stays on top of the issues local and national. He also does some of the most stimulating interviews you've ever heard. That's the Rick Amato Show Monday through Thursdays from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. here on Intelligent Talk 1170 KCBQ. You can also find Rick on AmatoTalk.com. Welcome back to our program. I'm convinced that today's generation of Christianity is quick to embrace the doctrine of forgiveness without really understanding it. Yes, the command to forgive is biblical, but it comes with two extremely important qualifications. First, there is a difference between forgiving and excusing. Second, there is also a distinction between who is or is not to be forgiven. Now, let's unpack these amendments one at a time. First, the difference between forgiving and excusing. The Bible is literally filled from start to finish with warnings against evil spoken by God through the mouth of his prophets and apostles. God called certain people evil, and God called certain nations evil as well. Jesus, speaking of Judas, said, "Did I not myself choose you, the 12, and yet one of you is a devil?" That's pretty severe. John the Baptist calls Herod evil. Jeremiah, speaking for God about Israel, says, "The people of Israel and of Judah have provoked me by all the evil they have done." That was at one time in Israel's history. Israel has not always been evil, but they were at that one time. Jeremiah, speaking of the king of Babylon, Israel's enemy, also says, "The evil Morakok became king of Babylon." Although the Bible teaches that everyone has a sinful nature, the Bible does not imply that every single human being is evil. Evil refers to a man or woman who have not yet dealt with their sin. They have seared their conscience. They've completely given in to sin. This is why a book like Proverbs distinguishes between the righteous man and the wicked man. Yes, a righteous man has his own sins to contend with as well, and yes, we all need the atonement of Christ on the cross. But righteous refers to one who is working through that process of sanctification with God's Spirit. Now, very important, a righteous man does not go around calling himself righteous. On the contrary, he refers to himself as sinful. The Bible defines sin as selfishness. And he cooperates with the Holy Spirit to have his heart continually purged and scrutinized. It's important that we not confuse a humbled child of God for a self-righteous religious person. Jesus came to deal with many sins, but the sin of self-righteousness was of special concern to him. Such people could not or would not admit or confront their own selfish natures. The Pharisees, religious teachers of the day, were in this category. Not all of them, certainly not all of them, but many of them. Jesus did not hold back when describing the Pharisees. He called them a brood of vipers. He called them whitewashed tombs with dead bones inside. Read over Matthew 23. Yes, Jesus said those things, the same Jesus who instructed us to forgive. If he came amongst us today and talked in such a manner to a self-righteous hypocrite, I'm telling you, some Christian, not knowing whom he was talking to, might remind Jesus that as Christians we are called to forgive. Jesus would also be exhorted to love his neighbor. The truth is, Jesus knew the difference between tough love and merciful love. With him, it was not a one-size-fits-all ministry. The woman caught in adultery was treated with tenderness and compassion. Why? Because she knew and admitted her sin. On the other hand, the Pharisees were so proud that they needed to be taken down a peg in order to be saved. At the beginning of the book of Acts, we do read about many Pharisees giving their lives to Christ. Others may have turned so evil in their self-righteousness that they reached a point of no return, blaspheming the Holy Spirit, and committing a sin even Jesus did not die for. When talking about such men, Jesus was speaking not to save people who are at a point of no return, but instead to warn those who were under their wicked influence. Indeed, he lamented that Pharisees made some of their own converts, and those converts, he said, were twice as fit for hell as they themselves were. Yes, as Christians, we proclaim the gospel, which means good news, the good news about a God who forgives us for our sins. But people, that is not the entire gospel. The gospel also teaches that God wants to deliver us from sins committed against us. This is why demons are cast out. This is why supernatural healing takes place, to release us from sickness that is the result of a sin-cursed world. This is why the Messiah was not only to die for the sins of Israel, but to rescue Israel from her enemies and rule over Israel as a benevolent king. This is why Jesus will return to save Israel and the church from her enemies. This is why in heaven, we will no longer fear murder, racism, or brutal oppression. We will be delivered from our own inclinations to do such things, and those who do not want to be delivered are separated out, spending an eternity in hell. This is why Jesus instructs us to spread his kingdom in the meantime, in the here and now. Why did Jesus call his gospel good news to the poor? Because the poor are the victims of a greedy society. God wants to deliver us from evil, and God wants us to warn people when evil is approaching. The early church spoke out against the evil of Roman slavery. Christians like Wilbur Wilberforce and Charles Finney followed the example of Paul and condemned the practice in England and America. In America, such condemnation of evil inspired the Civil War. Should the war not have been fought? Should Christians of the North and Christian slaves of the South have defined forgiveness as a willingness to roll over and allow slavery? In the days of World War II, was it proper for Christians to call the German Nazis evil? Was it proper to fight them? After all, not all Germans were Nazis, and some Nazis repented of their sins. Despite this truth, does it not seem right that Hitler was stopped and stopped by force, since Prime Minister Chamberlain's concessions were about as effective as an ice cube in the desert? As a pastor, I have done a great deal of counseling. Over the years, many came to me who had been scarred for life, some by their very own parents. I met men and women alike who had been beaten or molested. With others, it was not a matter of what a parent had done, but rather what they had not done. Some parents never told their own children that they loved them. These children grew up, and as Christians realized how much hurt they were carrying, in all cases, there was an anger against their parents. They heard somewhere that they must forgive, so they went through the motions of forgiveness, not really accomplishing anything, and obviously not feeling any better. Deep inside, they still wrestled tremendous rage and resentment. But now, a Christian guilt trip was laid on top of an already large pile of pain, as if things weren't depressing enough. They were also made to feel guilty for not forgiving, even though they had tried to forgive them time and time again. I said to many of my parishioners, the problem is that you are confusing forgiving with excusing. The reason you still feel angry is that you have not been freed up by Christians and granted permission by the church to express your anger. But Bob, isn't anger a sin? No, not all anger. God expressed his anger many times in the Bible. In Exodus 4, it says, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. In Ephesians, we read, be angry, but do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. Anger is not a sin. Inappropriate anger is a sin. And legitimate but misplaced anger is a sin. Anger at a person who has done you no wrong simply because you feel annoyed and have a bad temper is a sin. But if somebody has truly offended you by force, insult, gossip, or some other abuse, not only do you have a right to be angry, it would be emotionally unhealthy to not feel that way. Even so, what we do or fail to do with legitimate anger can also be a sin. If you've had a bad day at work and take the anger out on your family when you return home because you're too fearful to confront your boss, that is a sin. Anger held inside is also a sin because it ferments and becomes bitterness. Or anger released in a fit of rage is a sin because you are out of control. Appropriate anger must be expressed, but it can be verbalized without throwing furniture. Often I've sat down with people over a cup of coffee at Denny's, very calmly saying to them, let me tell you exactly how you made me feel when you spoke those comments last week. Without yelling, I'm releasing anger, and when I'm done with this benign encounter, I do not feel angry any longer. After sharing these truths, I would encourage my parishioners to confront their abusive parents, often with a letter so that they could take the time to carefully word things. The end of the letter might say something to this effect. I needed to get these burdens off my chest so that I no longer harbor bitterness toward you. I do not want to continue being angry, and sharing the anger was my way of stopping. It is my hope that by expressing this anger, we can heal our relationship. I want you to know that I do not excuse what you did. What you did to me was wrong, and it will always be wrong. However, now that I have confronted you, I do forgive you. And yet, supposing the parent does not seek forgiveness, has not asked for forgiveness, and does not feel they need forgiveness, in that case, the grown child still experiences a catharsis of released anger and evaporated bitterness. They now have an attitude of forgiveness, a forgiving heart, and a willingness to forgive their parent at any time. However, and this is my main controversial point, if the parent has not received such forgiveness, the relationship obviously is not healed. This means the one who will not receive forgiveness is not forgiven, which leads to our second qualification. There is also a distinction between who is or is not to be forgiven. Luke 17:3 says, if your brother sins, rebuke him. If he repents, forgive him. If he repents, forgive him. This is an extremely important and frequently overlooked qualification. Would not the reverse also be true? If he does not repent, do not forgive him. Luke 17 makes even more sense when we remember that God is our example here. Does God forgive everyone? I know that as Christians, we want to rush in and say, well, yes, of course. Now, you're correct in a sense, in as much as forgiveness is promised by God and commanded of Christians, but God not only authored those words, he went on to teach us what he meant by them. Question, will everybody be in heaven? No, only those who receive Christ, or more specifically put, only those who accept God's forgiveness. The person in hell for all of eternity does not feel forgiven, and in point of fact, is not forgiven. Yes, he could have been forgiven. Yes, God wanted to forgive him. Yes, Jesus died for his sins, but not all sins. The sin of refusing to accept Jesus, the sin of rejecting God's forgiveness, was not paid for. In similar manner, our friends or families are forgiven by us when they ask for forgiveness. I will continue this discussion of forgiveness next week. We will see you then.
Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.